Please be seated, everyone, and we'll call our next case, which is case number 64946, Peruzzi v. District Court. And we have Ms. Hurst et al., the real parties in interest. We have Mr. McBride, Mr. Cotton for the petitioners, Ms. Carmichael for the real parties in interest. Okay, you ready to proceed? Mr. Cotton, are you two going to split time, or are you going to just...
I'm going to take the whole thing.
Okay. Whatever you want. So, your time, whatever you want to do. So, okay.
I'm holding up the sacrificial.
Would you like to reserve some time for rebuttal?
5 minutes.
Okay. Very well.
I'm before this court to present an issue of first impression arising from a statute that obligates joint and several liability in medical malpractice cases and inserts pure several liability for the defendants. The issue before the court here isn't a factual issue that we need to get into detail with, and we did not in our briefs. We're not here to argue the underlying facts. Those arguments simply go to the weight of the party's evidence against all of the various health care providers. We're here to determine how the trial court must treat a settling or non-joined doctor and hospital in a medical malpractice case of several liability, which quite frankly, and as I know a lot of the judges from down south here have run into it, happens a lot in medical malpractice cases. NIS 41A45 is very clear.
Mr. Cotton, before you get too wrapped up and rolling on your argument, I think it's important for you to articulate why this court should entertain the writ. And you're saying we should entertain it because it is an issue of first impression and because it affects other cases in the system?
Yes, Your Honor. And it's also an issue of very strong public concern and its economy of time and trials on this case. If you go through a trial...
Can you comment on that a little bit, how this would affect the judicial economy?
I think, as a practical matter, there's a lot of cases that everyone knows going up on these medical malpractice matters at this point. The several liability issue is something that seems to be coming up more and more in all of the cases that we have. And what we're going to end up with is if you make it strictly a appellate issue as opposed to a writ issue, then what I think you run into is a bad verdict, one way or the other. If they don't get to put in evidence against any of the settling defendants or parties that have already joined as defendants but treated the patient, you're going to get an appeal from that verdict because there's no ability to truly parse out the percentage negligence of each of the parties.
But you still have 17245, and why doesn't the offset provision make this okay?
I don't believe that you have a right to offset, and people are going to shoot me for saying this. I don't believe you have a right to offset in a several liability case. In several liability, all you're responsible for is your percentage. You don't get into the offsets of other people. That's the situation.
The judge can't offset any of the settling defendants.
I don't believe that you can because those settling defendants, if you have had, let's say for example, just to give you a verdict of $1 million, and the jury found you to be 10% liable, that $100,000, none of that is caused by the remaining defendants. That's your conduct that's caused that, and that was the whole intent of this statute in the first place. There was a case called Levy that came down out of this course that started the whole fury of the caps. In Dr. Levy's case, it was a case with a midwife. He came down with a 10% responsibility and 100% of the verdict on top of him. And that was what got everything drummed and rolling. I mean, personally, I like it when all my co-defendants are paying all sorts of money. I know Judge Turing had a case where substantial amounts were paid. It made it fun for me to go to trial with all of this offset. But that's not the law. I don't have the benefit of what I enjoyed before.
Mr. Cotton, how do we even get into this when we don't have a comparative fault with the plaintiff in this, as we look at the interplay of 41A045, 41-141? How do we get into this at all?
You could have created that interplay at the time they did the statutes. If simply in 045 they had said, and in a case of comparative fault, revert back over to 41-141. But that's not what they said. They said it's a pure several liability case to be determined. Not only if you have comparative fault. They said this is the liability to be applied to these defendants, different from every other negligence type case.
Why should we even consider settled defendants in this situation? They settle. Why should we bring them back in when we have the 17 statutes sitting there?
Well, for starters, they're not brought back in. They're on evidence and on jury verdict form that the jury gets to consider.
That's where you want to put them.
Well, there's no further monetary exposure. They don't have to hear a trial. We're out of the case.
Doesn't that hurt your argument in the sense that there's no determination of liability, but yet you want to apportion a liability factor to them, and this was all part of a settlement? You do a settlement for a particular reason, whatever the reason may be, to avoid further litigation costs, to limit your exposure, but you never determine a liability amount. You put them on a special verdict form, and...
The only thing that gets applied on a special verdict form is a percent.
Correct.
Because that's what you need to determine. There's no judgment entered against them. There's no amount entered against them.
But shouldn't they have that opportunity? And doesn't that absolutely undermine the whole purpose of settling?
If they want to stay in the case and prove that they didn't do anything wrong, they have the opportunity if they want. That's a judgment call to be made by each individual defendant and the plaintiffs under those circumstances. But the fact of the matter is the plaintiff, in this case, is a good example. They said Dr. Conte was negligent. Now, because they settled out with him, all of a sudden keep Dr. Conte out of the case. But what you've essentially done then is you're putting the plaintiffs in the position of deciding what percentage my client's liability is going to be. To hold the way that Judge Bixler held here is basically saying you need to prove that 100% you didn't do it or 100% somebody else did it. But there is no allocation. There is no in-between. He didn't leave what the statute requires, which is a finding of what percentage of the damages were caused by my client.
Where is that required in the statute? And which statute?
In action for it's in 41A045. It says not be held liable to the plaintiff for non-economic and non-economic damages severally only, and not jointly. For that portion of the judgment, which
does 41A045 even apply? Is it applicable based upon how we are structured in this lawsuit?
Yes. If you're holding into this lawsuit that this is something covered by the medical malpractice statutes, my doctor's responsibility is civil. His doctor's responsibility is civil.
Don't we go a little bit further? We have this underlying assumption that we're looking at comparative fault and going back, which in this situation we don't even get into.
Yeah, but I
understand where you're going, but.
I'm not arguing this is a comparative fault case.
But you are against the other defendants. You're saying it's that novel circumstance where there's a comparative fault among the other defendants, and therefore that's why I'm trying to figure out why 17245 in the offset provision would...
Part of the problem, I think, we're getting locked into words, comparative fault.
Sure.
This is several liability. This is a completely different concept.
Understand.
Than comparative fault, where we've got a plaintiff that's theoretically contributory and negligent, then we allocate out among the main defendants, three cars hitting each other, that sort of a thing. This is a strict, pure, several liability for the doctors. This was their whole argument back at the time of the legislation. They're only liable for whatever percentage of the damages they caused. But you can't do that in a vacuum.
Mr. Cotton, in the trial, you would be arguing that my client either isn't liable or is only a certain percentage liable. It seems like you weren't precluded from presenting that evidence based on the court's in limine motion, right?
I'm not precluded from saying my client is not liable, period. I'm not precluded from saying that. What I am precluded from saying is even if you find my client liable at all, it's nominal. It's 5%. It's 10%.
So,
and that's what the statute
is. My question is, why is it necessary to include, I get your point about the evidentiary issues, but why is it necessary to include on the special verdict form, as we're sort of accustomed to when we're dealing with the comparative fault cases, the names of other people that you've pointed to as potentially liable? Why wouldn't we simply say your client is either liable or not liable, and if liable, liable to what percentage?
There's no, an example I was given to Mr. McBride was, compared to what? That's the problem with the their percentage of what? If you've got 10 defendants, it's one determination.
It's total fault. You're not suggesting that the plaintiff should be precluded from introducing all of the evidence that it has to show the full amount of recovery.
No.
So assuming that the plaintiff does that, the question in the case is, what is the percentage of liability, if any, of your client? Okay. Why can't the special verdict form ask that?
Because it does it in a vacuum then. Let's assume from which you've got five defendants. Four of them settle out. Unless the jury gets in the full expert testimony and causation
That's
testimony.
An evidentiary issue, not a special verdict form issue.
Well, it is because you're asking the jury to set a percentage on a form with no really relevance to the evidence around them. They've got to determine, in the context of everything that happened, what percentage was John Cotton's client. Not, well, you can't really talk about that. You can't say that Dr. Fauci did this or that, but determine what percentage I am, even though I can't talk about everybody over there. It becomes evidentiary.
I think we're communicating. I'm suggesting, in my hypothetical, that the district court's order on the in limine motion was an error in precluding you from introducing evidence about the potential liability of the other defendants.
I have no problem with that. I think you're correct. I was misunderstanding you.
It's a hypothetical. I haven't decided the case yet.
That's a correct.
But assuming for the moment that the court said that portion of the in limine order was incorrect, then it seems to me that the court's position about what would be reflected in the special verdict form is simply the question, what percentage, if any, is your client liable for?
And I would have no problem with that, provided that the trial courts, not just this trial court, because it happens regularly, but the trial courts are told, you cannot preclude the defendant from putting on evidence of other parties' negligence contributing to this or causing this injury. You don't have to put them on a verdict form, but you can't stop the defendants. Under this ruling, the court, I believe the court is correct, when you're looking at this, and under this ruling, I can't do that. And that's not fair to my client.
But again,
I can't get several.
How is that going to work as a practical matter? As you know, I preside over a number of these matters.
I do.
How is this going to work practically to where it doesn't take on a whole different life and a whole different aspect that's completely unrelated to the particular defendant involved?
In this particular case, it's a good example of this case.
Well, if you say you have five or six defendants, and then you've got five or six little mini trials. It sounds to me like what you're saying. That's the first thing I see is, you know, as a trial judge presiding over these things, then you've got five or six little mini trials. How much fault does Dr. Conte have in this? And here's why. And here's what he did. And this.
My client, not some insurance company. My client would say, why should I have to be hit for a $2 million verdict when I'm 10% liable and I can't even show what the other party's liability was? That's not fair. Mm-hmm. Usually, if you look at the law, I happen to believe what's fair is generally good law.
Right. And you also know when you come in on a good faith settlement, you did it a number of times. There's a fairly thorough determination as to whether or not the settling parties, whether or not it's a good faith settlement.
Now, the real problem is that now you're working into a real trap here, which is, okay, you can't put in evidence of other doctors there, and under several liability, I'm going to get my argument coming right back, under several liability, you can't get an offset for somebody else's negligence. So what you've done is put this doctor into a trap. And I don't believe that's what the legislature intended.
And what distinguishes this statute from 41-141 is paragraph 2 that says joint and several liability is completely abolished. There is only several.
Exactly.
And I think that gets overlooked a bit. Your point is 141 doesn't apply at all because this is pure several liability. Is
exactly.
That correct?
Yes, sir. Yes, Your Honor.
And following up on Justice Hardesty's question to you about a verdict form, what would your it's a percentage of something, of negligence. Whose negligence in that case, if everybody else settled out, how would that work?
I think the defendants have to come forward with testimony at trial, and to the trial itself.
Which defendants? I'm sorry. I don't mean to interrupt you.
Any remaining defendant.
Let's assume there's just one left.
There's just one defendant left, only the defendant, or in this case, two.
You're not talking about the settling defendant.
Right. The settling defendant, I don't think, has to do a thing. They've gone home and they're peaceful with themselves. but you have to have some evidence at trial that this was caused not just by this person, or not at all, but by these two people who are standing out there on Main Street. The people should not be out on Main Street conceptually. What they did factually should not be out on Main Street with them. That needs to remain in the case of the jury. It's a fraud on the jury, in my opinion, to not let them hear that testimony and have a doctor go to trial. That's inappropriate. I think it confuses a jury, and it's deceptive to a jury because they're not getting all of the facts that the case actually existed. And that's the problem that I personally have with it.
Mr. Cotton, I appreciate where you're coming from. The legislature seemed to do something else, and your interpretation may vitiate that. I guess my question for you really is, how do you look at Humphreys versus HJD at 129 Nevada as to 141 and its spinoff as to 145?
I'm not familiar with the Humphreys case. I don't have that.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Cotton, very much. Okay, Ms. Carmichael.
May I please the court? My colleague, Jeff Spade, will address the court on behalf of the plaintiff.
Okay, Mr. Spade, you may address the court.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, Jeff Spade on behalf of the real parties in interest in this case. Your Honors, we're here today on a writ of mandamus asking you to overturn Judge Fixler's decision when he excluded evidence of Dr. Conte's comparative fault. In doing so, Judge Fixler specifically relied on the plain language of NRS Section 41.141, which contains a prohibition against the admission of such evidence. He also relied on this court's decision in 2004, namely Banks versus Sunrise Hospital, where this court explained how 41.141 applies to a situation where a medical malpractice defendant settles out before the entry of trial. His decision based on those authorities to exclude that evidence cannot constitute manifest abuse of discretion.
How is 41.141 applicable in this case?
Your Honor, let me...
It's manifest abuse of discretion if it doesn't apply. Wouldn't you agree?
I would agree, and let me explain...
So how does it apply?
Let me explain to you. I think it's important to look at the entire history of the statute. Let's begin in 1989.
Before you go there, I'd like to hear the textual analysis, if you could. I don't mean to jump on your question, Justice Hardesty.
As to, Your Honor...
Looking at the statute and its language, how does it apply to this case?
Your Honor, the statute, 41.141, applies to all cases. There's no indication that 41.141 does not apply to medical malpractice cases. What we have here is in 2002, the legislature passed 41A045 to specifically deal with this court's decision in the Buck versus Greyhound case, which is a 1989 case. And if we look at those legislative materials, when the discussion was presented, or when the statute was presented, the legislature specifically acknowledged that in 1989, this court interpreted 41.141 in such a way that said, in situations where there's no comparative fault claim made back against the plaintiff, you don't have several liability.
But counsel, is anybody in this case asserting comparative negligence against your clients?
No, Your Honor.
Well, then how does 41.141, which specifically says in which comparative negligence is asserted as a defense, apply in this case, textually?
I would say we need to look at, number one, the plain language of the statute does not make reference to settled out defendants versus trial defendants versus non-parties. It says defendants. And this is what I'm trying to get at, Your Honor. When we look to the legislative history, the legislature specifically discussed this problem.
Why is it ambiguous? It seems to say what it says, and it seems pretty clear to me.
It's not ambiguous, Your Honor.
Why would you look to legislative history?
Because we're trying to determine the intent.
You don't do that if it's not ambiguous.
I understand that, Your Honor, but the question becomes, why does this apply? You know, if the plain language of the statute doesn't tell us why it applies, we can refer to the legislative history to help us expand on how the legislature intended for this to apply, not to construe it.
Well, but counsel, you have to tell us that. You have to tell us why 141 applies. And I think that's the repeating question that you're getting all the way down this bench. Tell us where the comparative negligence claim is.
There is no comparative negligence
claim. Then it doesn't apply.
Your Honor, I would point the court specifically to in the July 30th, 2002, discussion specifically on 41A045 when it was being presented. A legislature asked the specific question you're asking, how does it apply? And the response to that was, it doesn't change the comparative fault statute. What the legislature intended to do was it acknowledged the restriction.
Well, of course it wouldn't change the comparative fault statute in cases in which comparative fault is raised. Right. But it's not being raised in this case.
That's what the legislature wanted to fix. In the discussion that they have, they specifically say, look, under Buck, if you have a medical malpractice plaintiff who was unconscious when they were injured by medical malpractice, under Buck, there's no joint, there's no several liability. You apply joint and several liability. But the legislature said, we don't want to do that. So what we want instead to happen is all the time when you have a medical malpractice case, we want it to be several liability.
Counsel, didn't 41045 come into play after Buck, after this, and is applicable to this case?
Your Honor, yes. The decision.
So the Buck analysis, talking about what to do about severable liability and joint and several liability, doesn't even apply. The legislature in 41045 defined what is joint and or abolished joint liability for economic and non-economic damages and said we're talking now only about several liability. So the district court judge in this case appears to have made a decision on an in limine motion, number two, and decided the case using a statute that doesn't apply and a case that didn't apply.
Your Honor, the claim...
So shouldn't the judge reevaluate the in limine motion relying on statutes that do apply?
Your Honor, I would say no because 41-141 applies. And that's the point I'm trying to make with the legislative history, is the court, the legislature understood the problem with Buck. And in their discussions, as I began explaining, they specifically addressed a situation where there is no comparative fault claim made against the plaintiff. And that troubled the legislature. Now, in 2002, they passed a bill, Assembly Bill 1, that held medical malpractice defendants jointly responsible for non-economic damages and severally liable as to economic damages. That's what they did in 2002.
You're talking about the legislative intent. The people of this state voted in 41045 in Coden.
Your Honor, that's not entirely correct. In 2002, this 41A045 was passed, and it split the damages, making part of it joint and several liability and the other part several liability.
Mm-hmm.
In 2004, the ballot initiative came about to extend several liability across the board for all categories of damages.
To say categorically that we, the voters, are abrogating joint and several liability in professional malpractice cases. I mean, that came out of the 2004 ballot initiative. And to me, that's an across-the-board cut. It says what it says.
The ballot does say that we're going to make, in terms of damages, all damages severally liable to all defendants. It does say that.
And that's new. I mean, regardless of your 2002 argument, that subparagraph 2 that says the voters intend to abrogate joint and several liability of a provider of health care in an action for injury or death against the provider of health care.
Yes, Your Honor, that paragraph does say that, and I think you have to look at it in context. When before, 2 years before that ballot initiative occurred, you had a statute, the same version of the statute, split the categories of damages.
I understand that. You're saying economic, non-economic. I take that point. But this subparagraph 2 is new and emphatic. To me, the statute says what it says, and there's been no post-enactment amendment of it to somehow bring it under 141.
I would argue that based on the information we have from the ballot initiative, specifically the ballot information that was presented to the voters for them to vote on, the information says that we're going to extend the rationale in making economic damages separate from the 2002 bill. We're going to extend it to non-economic damages as well. So I don't think that based on the information we have here, that the 2004...
What about 41045 post-2004 is ambiguous? anything?
41A045 states that each defendant is responsible for his share. Dr. Conte is not a defendant. And 41A045
says... But subparagraph 2 is broader than that.
I would argue, Your Honor, that the paragraph, subparagraph 2 addresses the ballot initiative's intent to extend that several liability doctrine across all damages. I don't, from the information we have, I don't know that we can safely say that it intended to create pure several liability in the purest sense.
I'm not big on intent in statutes, but the wording of this doesn't seem to me to be ambiguous. And that's both 41.141 and 41A045. I'm struggling to see an ambiguity in either.
So I would take the position that they're not ambiguous. And if you apply 41A045, it says each defendant is responsible for his percentage of fault. Dr. Conte is not going to be on the verdict form because he's not a defendant. But the current defendants will be on the verdict form. The jury.
But he was a defendant. He settled out.
Yes, Your Honor. But the statute does not speak about past defendants or not parties who used to be defendants. That's dealt with.
So these parties, counsel, Mr. Spade, have been settled, were dismissed from the case, so they're no longer parties at the time the case goes to verdict. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. And, so they're out. They're done. So the only people left that are to be considered in the verdict are the people that are still the defendants. They're not people that are gone.
Right, right.
That's your argument.
But backing up again, if we take 045 and 141 at what we think they say on their face, answer the question of what do the defendants who remain show to a jury in terms of honest explanation of why their client may only be a small percentage responsible. How do they do that if, in fact, we allow this type of an in limine motion ruling to stand?
Your Honor, I don't know that they're entitled to do that under 41.141. I mean, in Banks, this court said, number one, you can argue it's all of the other doctor. They can argue that at trial. They can also argue it's not us. We're not the proximate cause of this injury. So the jury gets to hear about Dr. Conte in this case. They get to hear about what they believe he did wrong and how he caused the injury.
I'm not sure that they would under this ruling, but we can reasonably disagree.
Well, and I'm just focusing on Banks. This is what Banks said, that evidence of comparative fault or allocation of fault doesn't come in, but they can argue he's 100% at fault or we didn't proximately cause the harm. That's the point. That's the reading of Banks. That's what Banks did.
Banks predates 045.
Banks came in 2004.
Yeah.
Yes,
yeah.
Your Honor. But I would argue, again, if you look at how the law has evolved.
Well, let's talk about the policy of this. If a doctor is severally liable, and let's assume for the moment, credit your argument that Banks somehow does apply, why would we continue or extend that rule when the doctor is only severally liable in comparison to all the liability of the other doctors who were sued, whether they're in the case today or not?
Your Honor, for the simple fact that we have two statutes, part of 41.141 and 17.245, that specifically allowed the trial defendants to get a full credit of all the money that has been paid by the settled out defendants.
Why would they get a credit if they're only severally liable? They're getting a credit for somebody else paying for a liability that they don't share in? That doesn't make sense.
That's the law, Your Honor.
Really?
Address Mr. Cotton's argument that 17.245 doesn't apply.
Your Honor,
you don't apply an offset.
There's a provision in 41.141 that incorporates the principle of 17.245.
You're assuming 41.141 applies in this case.
Yes, Your Honor. And that's the whole point of this discussion is, you know, the goal of this court is to take the statutes on the books and harmonize them. You have one statute who does not speak about settled out defendants, and you have another one that does. And
then if we disagree with your premise that 141 applies, what happens to your argument?
I don't know, Your Honor. That's a good question. If 41.141 does not apply, I think what we would be doing would be taking this court's decision in Banks. We would be taking...
So you still want us to apply Banks?
I think Banks is sound law, Your Honor. There's nothing since Banks that has changed.
Mr. Spade, some of the practical problems I see as a former district judge is if you have a lawsuit against defendants A, B, and C, and B and C have settled, and you think you're going to try the case against A, and but you're going to turn around and try against B and C, you might in court have been dismissed, but these trials are going to trip on time. You know, these districts are going to have litigation. These people don't even, aren't even in the courtroom. This is going to be a nightmare of all nightmares for the district court having to manage these cases and all like that. And why would the plaintiffs settle with B and C if they're going to be litigated against them and they're defaulting and have some stream of trial? Is there any reason to settle with them at that stage?
Well, Your Honor, at trial, the plaintiffs would not be, in this case, the plaintiffs would not be advancing the argument of let's take a look at Dr. Conte's fault in this. We're here on the remaining two defendants' fault.
That's but doesn't that leave you at a disadvantage because then the defendants would have the opportunity to create, as I said earlier, these little mini trials where you may have five or six different defendants.
Your Honor, how...
And isn't that a benefit to them, to your detriment?
Your Honor, how that pans out, I mean, this we're controlled by what the legislature wants us to do, and I understand the practical concern of this, but we're bound by what the legislature enacted. May I finish this brief comment? We're bound by what the legislature has indicated that has to happen, and as this court held in Warbrot, whether or not this works or not really isn't the issue. We're here to apply the legislative enactments. And it's up to the legislature to fix it.
So the idea here is that you want to settle with defendants, go against one defendant, and assert against the remaining defendant the entirety of the liability that your client or damages your client has incurred.
Without an offset.
Without an offset.
No. They're entitled to an offset. They get the offset. Huh. I don't mean to...
The source of the offset is 17245. That's the statutory basis for the offset.
As well as 41-141 subsection cases.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Mr. Cotton, you used up all your time, but I'll give you a minute. We asked a lot of questions, so let's get you a chance to respond.
I appreciate that. If I could just, Judge Hogan, if I could just address your issue of mini trials. It won't be multiple mini trials. It's a trial of the facts of this case. This here will not be many trials. We're going to talk about a child was born, child's care during that time, the care by Dr. Conte afterwards and my clients. It's not multiple cases. It's a question the jury now being presented with all of the facts and solid expert testimony. They decide, not the plaintiff, by settling with someone. They decide.
So with each settling defendant, and you want to point a finger at the settling defendants and bring in your experts, you're going to have to come in with some other expert to rebut this, and I don't understand how this doesn't create a bunch of little mini trials.
Because under the concept that you don't, as Judge Hardison and I were talking about, that you don't have a verdict form that presents, I don't really care about that. I want to be able to argue. My clients was minimally negligent at all here. The only way I can do that is to put on evidence of the person they obviously consider to be heavily involved at $2 million settlement. That's a big deal. That's a defendant that should be in there for, not a defendant, but it's facts that a jury needs to have in front of it in order to allocate to my client or not allocate to my client whatever percentage liability is there.
Great. Thank you very much.
I got a question. Mr. Cotton, please. Is Banks still good law?
I think Banks is good law in a setting outside of the malpractice setting. They've abolished joint and several liability. Banks started out with a premise of joint and several liability and worked its way through 141. 141, in my opinion, does not apply to a medical malpractice action such as this. If they wanted to have comparative fault apply and say that several is out of it, they could have said that. They did not, and I think the statute's clear.
Okay.